I'm Sean Graham, and what's old as news this week are Canadian prime ministers. Since Confederation in 1867, 23 people have been first among equals in the House of Commons, serving as Canadian prime ministers, with 10 years being counted in as long as decades and as short as months. It's a unique position, to be sure, in the Canadian political landscape. Rare air to achieve that position. And while it does mean that you are the head of the government, it also puts you in a rather unique position culturally. You are the individual who is out speaking for the country, representing Canada internationally, the first voice that people hear in moments of great national crisis, and in certain cases, great national celebration. So it goes beyond a purely political function, as the prime minister is there in moments that transcend political and partisan life. And the way in which the individuals who have held that office have shaped national identity since the Second World War is the subject of a new book by Raymond Blake entitled Canada's Prime Ministers and the Shaping of a National Identity. In this book, Raymond Blake goes through the prime ministers since the end of the Second World War, starting with William Lyon Mackenzie King, getting up into Stephen Harper, a little bit about Justin Trudeau, not that much, as he'll talk about as to why, but going through and exploring how the prime ministers, how the office, and how the individuals who have served in that office have influenced and shaped a specific national identity for Canada, and how that has also influenced our understanding of the position of prime minister as well. There's a bit of a reciprocal relationship going on between the prime minister coming out and shaping, defining a certain national identity, but also responding to the Canadian public, a rather interesting dynamic at play. And Raymond Blake is one of the best at studying Canadian political history. Really like the idea of the book, and I was very excited when I had a chance to go through it. Wonderfully researched, goes into a lot of prime ministerial speeches, gets at the language that's used, tone that's used, the way in which messages are being conveyed by the various prime ministers. Just a wonderful profile of the office. And I was very pleased to have the opportunity to speak with him about the book and a little bit more. I was really pleased with how this turned out. Enjoyed it. Hope you will as well. So let's get right into my chat with Raymond Blake. All right. And Raymond Blake joins me now. How are you today?
Wonderful, Sean. Good to see you.
Yes, good to see you again. Full disclosure, I did my master's at the University of Regina, and Dr. Blake was on the committee that granted me ultimately that degree. So it's his fault if you don't like anything I do, or partly his fault. Very excited to talk to you today about the new book, Canada's Prime Ministers and the Shaping of National Identity. The first question that I wrote down when I was looking at the book and thinking about how we wanted to attack this is one of the terms that comes up in the description of the book, which is identity entrepreneurs, is how it's described, that prime ministers were identity entrepreneurs. So how do you define that term, and how does it associate itself with the role of the prime minister?
You know, I and Sean, I should say, we were delighted to have you at the University of Regina a number of years ago, and we do take credit for all of your great work that you do. And we're glad to have you as one of our alumni. So get that out of the way first. You know, one of the things, I've been sort of interested in notions of identity, citizenship, and a number of the things that I've written have dealt with that very loosely. And you know, when we think about Canadian identity or Canadian nationalism, you know, there's all sorts of things you can point to, you know, whether it is various symbols like making the flag, whether it is Margaret Atwood and you know, the how we love it when she wins a Booker Prize or whatever. And you know, we talk about hockey and we talk about the RCMP and Tim Hortons and donuts and so on. But, you know, I was thinking that really the spokesman for the nation is not Margaret Atwood or Tim Horton or some other hockey player, but it is the prime minister. You know, the prime ministers are invested in the nation. But you know, the prime minister invests is life really in building the nation. And that's what I mean by he's an entrepreneur. He's an entrepreneur in storytelling. He's an entrepreneur in building particular narratives. And they're invested in it in a very meaningful way. And sometimes those efforts, you know, are not just about a particular prime minister, but there's great continuity in the stories they tell from one to the other.
Why do you think the prime minister takes on that role? Because there are other roles in the country that have a prominent place. I think the most obvious one that would come to people's minds is the governor general. And to a certain extent, the governor general is there in that ceremonial role. They're always there giving out Order of Canada, investing people into that. Like, part of that job is to create that identity or to be a representative of that. Obviously, the monarch's representative in Canada as well. But generally speaking, they take on that more ceremonial role that I would typically associate it with these things that are forming national identity. So what is it then specifically about the prime minister different from some of those other positions?
Yeah, you know, I think that's a great point. And one of the things that I looked at in the book, paid a lot of attention to, was the speech from the throne. And as you know, the speech from the throne is read by the governor general. And whether he or she, you know, stands and says, my government, but what they're really meaning is my prime minister. And the prime minister writes the speeches from the throne. The governor general just reads them. And the government, and we've often say this, and I think there was a website in Library and Archives Canada a little while ago called First Amongst Equals, that had as its focus the prime minister. And although in a parliamentary system that we have, we always think of the prime minister as just one of the others. But he's not first among equals. You know, it is his policy. Everybody who runs in the parliament under his, you know, party, he has to approve, or one of his minions will approve. He is the one that selects the cabinet. He will fire the cabinet. He will see, as we've seen with Mr. Trudeau, you know, will kick people out of caucus. And so, you know, and when there's a national crisis, we don't go to the governor general or a cabinet minister. We want to see what, in this case today, Justin Trudeau is saying about those things. So the prime minister is the one that gets all of the attention. He's the one that really sets the agenda. And I argue he's the one that helps to create and tell the story that sometimes the cabinet ministers will follow, but it comes from him or from his office.
And how much does it influence that role, the fact that we have prime ministers who might not stick around for a while, right? Just the nature of the position, parliamentary politics, the position can be held for a very short amount of time, as we've seen, right? John Turner, Kim Campbell, there's the few in the 1890s, right? That there's people who can sit in that office for a short amount of time. Does that have any impact on how we view the position or the role's influence on identity at all?
Yeah, you know, I think it does. And you know, one of the things I probably must apologize for in the book is, and I had this issue when we were dealing with a copy editor for the book, because I would sometimes refer to prime minister as he or they or he or she or whatever the case may be. And the copy editor commends me, hey, all the Canadian prime ministers that's been important and long serving have been men. So let's use he, even though it's probably not the proper word to use these days. And I don't pay any attention really to John Turner, nor, and of course the book covers the period from 1945 to Stephen Harper, a little bit about Justin Trudeau, but not a lot. And I don't deal with Kim Campbell, and I deal a little bit with Paul Martin, but Joe Clark, you know, gets a little bit of attention, but not a lot. And so I think these individuals do have stories to tell, but I don't think they were pivotal in changing the direction or forcing us in a particular way as opposed to a different narrative. So, yeah, you know, the prime minister changed. And one of the things that I argue in the book, it really doesn't matter what political party they are. And if you look at it in the period since 1945, there's a great deal of consistency and continuity in the story that's being told, whether it's conservative, whether it's progressive conservative, or whether it's liberal. They're all very similar in creating this notion of Canada as a small-held, liberal, caring society, and one that sort of the international realm remains pretty consistent through most of those prime ministers.
So I want to get into sort of the changing role of the prime minister in this post-war period. And one of the things that, of course, I studied at the University of Regina and in my PhD as well is radio and the shift of communication. And I'm curious, because we start in the book with Mackenzie King, and Mackenzie King, with all due respect to R.B. Bennett, is the first mass communication prime minister. And how much does the ability for the prime minister to speak to the whole country in one address, how does that potentially change the role, where I've argued in my stuff that the role of the local representatives kind of starts, that's where you start to see it not matter as much. It really becomes the party flag and the leader that people tend to associate more and more. But does that play a role in this shifting of identity and their role in shaping that?
You know, I think it does. Now, one of the things that I don't do a lot of in the book, and I know you do some of this in some of your work, is this reception theory. It's one thing for, you know, prime minister to say on the radio or in speeches or in television, you know, something. And then is it sort of accepted? And is it then sort of become a part of the normative story? And I deal with a few surveys throughout the book that says, yeah, you know, if you look at Canadians from coast to coast to coast, whether men, women, newcomers, long established people, that they in public opinion surveys and Quebec too, they're very similar on where they stand on particular issues like social responsibility of the state, about Canada's role internationally, about the use of bilingualism, the use of, you know, the multiculturalism and the Charter of Rights, great consistency across the country. And you're right that, you know, the radio does make the prime minister a much more pivotal figure. And one of the things that you see happening is, even though radio comes around and, you know, widely used by the 1940s, that you're still seeing many of the speeches of the prime ministers either packaged by the political party and sent around to the party faithful. And sometimes, in the case of Louis Saint-Laurent, for example, he would deliver a speech in, you know, French and English. Mackenzie King could not. Right. But what Mackenzie King would do in a number of cases is that he would read a speech on CBC Network, and then it would be followed by the same speech read on the French language network by Louis Saint-Laurent. So there was a real attempt to reach both linguistic groups in Canada. And at times, I can't, you know, claim the veracity of any of this, but looking at some of the newspapers in languages like Finnish and others, that the speeches would be translated and put into some, at least excerpts of them. Now, I don't read Finnish, for example, but, you know, they claim it was a text from the prime minister that he gave at some event. And so, yeah, there's the prime minister takes on added importance, but it's not until, I believe, about 1991 or 92, they stop reporting or carrying the text of a particular speech by a prime minister almost in its entirety in newspapers across the country.
Wow.
I've seen any recently, and maybe because prime ministers don't give the two-hour speeches anymore.
Yeah, I was thinking that. Yeah, when was the last time a prime minister got up and gave a long speech? I can't think of one, certainly with this government. And I don't remember Stephen Harper doing long speeches either. So yeah, it seems like it's been at least a couple long governments since that has taken place. Within that, I'm curious about Mackenzie King as a person, right? Because we're tracing this in the post-war period, and Mackenzie King is celebrated and derided for a lot of different things over the course of his career, but he does span such a wide swath of time, right? Prime minister in the 1920s through the post-war period. Is there anything that he does specifically that leads to this changing place of the prime minister or becoming the barometer of identity, pushing identity forward? Is there something specific to him, or is it part of the just changing world and the changing political atmosphere of the post-war period?
You know, that's an excellent question, Sean. And one of the things that I struggle with is, you know, Mackenzie King was, you know, people like, you know, F.R. Scott said, you know, Mackenzie King did nothing by halves, he could do by quarter. Right. And you know, people like Ridge Whitaker, a great political scientist, and others who said, you know, this person is not noted for for his originality.
Yeah.
And you know, and even Michael Bliss, you know, another great historian, you know, see Mackenzie King as just a pragmatist. He did whatever he necessarily, as little as necessary. But, you know, when you think about it, you read his speeches, you get a different story. And what I see is Mackenzie King, who should be regarded as a remarkable individual because he was in many ways a product of the 19th century, certainly the early 20th century. And he comes to the 1940s. And there's an all new dialogue going on around the world. And Mackenzie King pretty much taps into that. And within his government, and I don't make the claim that the prime minister makes all of these decisions on their own, because he would not. They're influenced by, you know, academics, by people within the government. They're influenced by what's in the media. You know, Mackenzie King is greatly influenced by Lord Beveridge in the United Kingdom, with Franklin D. Roosevelt, the New Deal, and so on. But Mackenzie King, you know, in the 1940s, says the world is changing and Canada must change and I must change with it. And one of the things, there's a wonderful speech that he gives in Parliament where he says, you know, for most of my career, I was only concerned about what was happening in Canada. And you probably noticed in the 1935 election, you know, in Mackenzie King, there's a problem going on in Ethiopia. And Mackenzie King says, you know, in that campaign, to Canadians, rest assured, we're not going to send a single lad overseas to protect the interests of some country, you know, halfway around the world. And by 1939, 1940, particularly before the 1942, the King stands out in Parliament and says, you know, I spent most of my time being an isolationist. And then going forward, that option is no longer in play. Canadians got to realize if they want a world safe for freedom and a place that's a better than we inherited coming into the war, then Canadians got to realize they have a role internationally. And even though Mackenzie King privately, look at his diaries, he's extremely worried about this stuff. But publicly, he says, hey, Canada, we got to participate. And he would speak in speeches about, and I'm making this number up because I can't remember it, but he would say, you know, before 1939, we participated in 6 international conferences. If you look at Canada in 1944, we're participating in 89 international conferences. And we got to do that because Canadians are global citizens. And as people who can care about the world, we are our brother's keeper. And he used that word a lot. And we got to sort of participate. And he was worried about the United Nations. And we also see this, and I'll stop after this, we also see this in, you know, he was really concerned about poverty and about, you know, what Canadian families who are, whether it's women going home to take care of their families, which he saw as important, or men coming back from Europe who have fought in the war. He said they want a different world. And of course, he gets us a variety of social programs, not as many as he promised, and not as many as he talked about, because he talked about healthcare, about sort of a form of Medicare in the 1940s. And he pulled back from all of those, but he did give us, you know, veterans benefits, unemployment insurance, family allowance. And privately, he said, it's crazy to think about the state giving $8 a month for every child across the country. But publicly, he talked about how important it was to reestablish the foundations of the family, which had been torn asunder. And for him, I've talked about this elsewhere, but social citizenship becomes an important element of the Canadian story. Mm-hmm. Canada is a caring nation. Canada is concerned about poverty. Canada is concerned about equity, although we define equity different today than we did then. But equity is a word that the Mackenzie King talks about a lot.
And how foundational is that? And I say that because now that I live in Ottawa and I've been part of the government for a while, the wheels of bureaucracy can move quite slowly, maybe not as slow, maybe a little slower now than they did then, but it's hard to really pivot government priorities, policies, especially when it comes to attitudes and ideas. So even though you have Louis St. Laurent come in and then Diefenbaker, like there's changes of people, but how foundational is that perspective that gets put into place right after the war with Mackenzie King in shaping up the second half of the 20th century?
You know, I think it's pivotal. And, you know, we can talk about a variety of things, but take something that, you know, we don't talk about much anymore, except probably when Stephen Harper was around, we talked a little bit about Dominion Day. You know, Mackenzie King wanted to change the name of Dominion Day. And he really wrestled with what does the word Dominion mean? And is it subservience? You know, people who were supported, like the Conservatives and the Social Credit, said, hey, you know, Australia wants to be a dominion. South Africa wants to be a dominion because Canada's sort of created this sort of class that is sovereign, independent, in a way, maintain ties to the empire. But Mackenzie King said there's a number of people, particularly in Quebec, who see Dominion as too much of the British. And so Mackenzie King, I think, has about five or six attempts to change Dominion Day to Canada Day. And then Louis Saint Laurent tries the same thing. So does Diefenbaker says, no, Dominion Day is just fine. Pearson says, you know, Dominion Day really got to be changed. But it's Pierre Trudeau in 1982 before Canada Day or Dominion Day becomes Canada Day. So it's a long history. I think there are 46, I know the number here, I'm not making it up. There are 46 attempts from 1943 to 1982 to change Dominion Day to Canada Day. Now, and of course, every prime minister spoke on Canada Day and released an official statement on Canada Day. And they all are dealing with the same issues, you know, diversity, inclusion, caring, Canada's place in the world, Canada as an example to the world. And they come and go, but these narratives remain pretty consistent throughout that. And we also see just one other example, free trade. You know, Mackenzie King talked about free trade. He came so close to a free trade deal with the Americans. Louis Saint Laurent never talked about free trade, but he wanted greater international cooperation between Canada and the United States. St. Lawrence Seaway is a good case in point. You know, Diefenbaker worried about this, but still he wanted free trade within the Commonwealth. And Pearson, of course, got a sectorial free trade. Mm-hmm. At the end of his career, Trudeau, you know, talked about sectorial free trade. And the Liberals, of course, opposed Brian Mulroney on NAFTA or first CFTA, then NAFTA. And what did Chrétien do? You know, he tried to make look like he got a new deal for Canada, but he didn't. And he accepted it. And now, of course, here we are in 2024. And if anyone were to say, let's tear up the free trade agreement with the United States and Mexico, you know, they'd probably lose power pretty quickly.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. A real transition in the way that is approached. I'm wondering within the, sort of a similar idea, because you mentioned Canada as an example, Canada's place in the world. How much of what the prime ministers are doing is related to politics, not necessarily in a partisan way? Is, you mentioned that it's really both stripes that are doing this, but there are political gains to talking about Canada as a world leader, as being an example to other countries. So how does the messaging play politically in trying to just garner support?
Yeah, no, you know, you can't lose sight of the fact that every prime minister is a politician and a party leader. And you know, while their message is sort of, you know, invested in building the story and sustaining unity and cohesion, it's also about building solidarity within the political base. Yes. And certainly, I think for most prime ministers, we see that. But, you know, I don't know how many speeches, but hundreds of speeches, thousands of speeches. And you know, you can see coming through in them a sort of a commitment and an ideology that moves beyond just partisanship. And so people like Mackenzie King, you know, went to Dieppe, you know, shortly after the war, and talked about how Canada could be an example to the world. Louis Saint-Laurent went to India on a world tour and said, you know, I know you got problems with Pakistan. I know you got problems, you know, here with the British and so on. But, you know, look to Canada. We've become a great nation incrementally. Just be patient. Work within. And, of course, that's easy for Louis Saint-Laurent to say. But, of course, Mulroney took a little different stance with South Africa, right? You know, very much in favor of, you know, Mulroney was probably the first prime minister to say what happens in the boundaries of a nation state does concern us. Whereas, you know, Pierre Trudeau frequently said, you know, we got no business interfering in what's happening internally, perhaps because he had to deal with Quebec in a more serious way than did many of the other prime ministers. But yeah, they are playing retail politics. There's no doubt about that. But I don't think that is their top priority. And frequently, people would say with Louis Saint-Laurent, for example, in the Hungarian Revolution, that, you know, they took in large numbers of, you know, refugees after the Soviets invaded, and it was, you know, to play to the immigrant community. But if you look at Louis Saint-Laurent from really his time in politics, he's very, very, very anti-communist. Mm-hmm. And anything to sort of make the communists look bad, he's going to do. Although I suspect in 1950s Canada, being, you know, warning about the evils of communism, it's probably a bit of a vote getter too.
Sure. Yeah. And well, I guess that brings in the question of the Cold War, and really for the bulk of the what you're covering in the book, there's the unity of the Cold War that until the wall falls, until really the Kretschmann government's the first one that doesn't have to deal with the Soviet Union in sort of the, for the entirety of their government. How does that kind of force a certain identity onto the role of the prime minister, whether it's nationalism or just democracy, anti-communist, whatever, however you want to define it? How is that kind of prescribed upon them? And how do they try to navigate that by putting their own personal spin on things?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question too, Sean. And you know, you're beginning, you see this right from Mackenzie King. In one of his visits, Mackenzie King traveled a lot around the world. And, you know, he went to France a number of times, England all the time. But he went to Berlin just after the Second World War, when the blockade of Berlin is happening and so on. And he gives a speech that calls upon the great powers, United States and Soviet Union, to do what's right for mankind, or humankind, I guess we would say today. And you know, just put the petty differences aside and let's help Berlin. Let's help, you know, the German people into a new world. And that is played in the United States and particularly in Canada as here's a statesman telling world leaders they can do better. And of course, you see this with Mulroney as well, you know, and Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan, the disputes he had with them. And you know, and Canadians applaud those things. And the only time that someone finds themselves offside in this narrative of Canada's place in the world, I think, is John Diefenbaker. In the Cuban Missile Crisis, you know, John Diefenbaker didn't ask for much. John Diefenbaker is very easy to ridicule. And one of the things that I found striking reading his speeches, he said, you know, we got to be masters of our own house. And he said, you know, not that I don't believe John F. Kennedy, but why don't we send the United Nations into Cuba to see what's really going on? And if it's as bad as it looks, then Canada certainly will be on side to deal with the Soviets. John Diefenbaker was very much like Chrétien in the Iran war or Iraq war. And he said, if the United Nations says this is a problem, we're in. If the United Nations don't condone it. But Canadians were so fearful of the Soviet Union, they dismissed John Diefenbaker's warnings about the Americans controlling our defense and military policy. And of course, as you know, they were pretty, well, not all of them, but, you know, he lost the next election in part because of his poor handling of the Cuban Missile Crisis.
And I think it speaks to a certain idea, too, of how important the international becomes for Canada in the second half of the 20th century. And again, I'm curious, as it relates to the political side of it, are prime ministers responding to the Canadian public's increased interest, or seemingly increased interest to me, and really how, I don't want to say divisive some of these issues were, but some of them are divisive when we're talking about certainly Vietnam, the way Canada responds to the Vietnam War, its posture towards the United States, as well as the Soviet Union, things that are happening elsewhere in Asia, not just in Vietnam and South America. Like, there's a lot going on in the world in the second half of the 20th century. And there seems to be an expectation that Canada will respond in some way, even if it's just through words in some cases. So how much of what prime ministers are doing is responsive to a public that is asking for it versus getting out ahead of public sentiment?
Yeah, you know, I wrestle with trying to determine what came first there. The prime ministers frequently take their cues from what Canadians are thinking. And the point that I make in the book is that the narrative that the prime ministers are telling is never for long out of line with what Canadians want. And now, whether it's Canadians fall into line or whether it's the prime minister backtrack and go with things, I think there's in some cases there's been both. I think, you know, in Canada, we think about South Africa and for very, you know, we like to think, hey, you know, we were the leaders on South Africa when it came to the international community and understanding the goals of Nelson Mandela and others. But even within Moroni's government, there were a number of people, even in cabinet, who were sympathetic to South Africa and worried about white South Africa and believed that we should get involved, but only incrementally, and that sanctions were not something that would be beneficial. But Moroni made it very clear to his cabinet that, A, there's only one position on South Africa. And that is racial equality. And I think Canadians were very keen on accepting that idea. And how best to achieve it? There was debate, of course. Mm-hmm. But I think on the fundamental principle of racial equality, it was a constant theme in the prime ministers. Although that became the normative story, the actual history of, you know, race relations in Canada has not been a pretty one.
No, for sure not. And that does lead into the question of multiculturalism in the second half of the 20th century as it becomes official policy of the Canadian government, while also opening immigration to a wider swath of the world, that there were more restrictive immigration policies in the first half of the 20th century and earlier. So people from around the world are coming to Canada in this time. The demographics are changing. It's not as high a percentage of people from Britain and France and similar parts of Western Europe. So within that realm, how does that necessarily change questions of identity when the country is changing demographically, and yet the prime minister is a singular person? It can't represent — their job is to represent everybody, but it can't really represent everybody. So are you seeing that notion of identity shifting along with the demographics?
Yeah, you are. But I think that, and this is a point that Stephen Harper made, Louis Saint-Laurent certainly, is one of the things that the prime ministers do frequently is, you know, they tell stories. And one of the stories they tell is of Confederation itself. And they even go back frequently to Louis LaFontaine and Robert Baldwin coming together in the 1840s. And, you know, a little heritage moment, right, when LaFontaine goes to Toronto and is elected by the English and the Protestants. And one of the things they talk about constantly is diversity. And I don't think I wrote it down here, but one of the things that Pierre Trudeau talked about a lot, he said the fathers of Confederation — and we sometimes have problems today, of course, with fathers of Confederation phrase — but he said that the people who made Canada had a dream. They had a dream that individuals who were different, of different races, and granted, they defined race as Irish, Welsh, you know, yeah, Scots, English. They had the idea that those people could live together and build a nation where all could flourish, regardless of their ethnicity. And Pierre Trudeau would say, it is our responsibility to live up to that dream. And Louis Saint-Laurent, you know, doesn't use the word multiculturalism, but he talks about a multicultural Canada, as does Lester B. Pearson. And John Diefenbaker, of course, doesn't use multiculturalism, but he talks about the non-English and French-speaking people, people who are neither French nor English like he was. Right. And so you're beginning to see that. And so this gets played out. And then finally, of course, we get the Multiculturalism Act in 1971, or the act comes a little bit later in 1988, but the multicultural policy comes with Trudeau in 1971. But what is also interesting, and I make this point, although I don't think it's going to matter much because people have their mind made up about Mackenzie King. And he gave that speech, you probably know it, in Parliament, you know, in 1946, 47, where he said, it's Canada's choice who we allow into this country.
Right, yeah.
And you know, it's the white Canada forever speech. And that gets quoted and quoted and quoted. But if you read the full speech on immigration policy, and I have it open here, Mackenzie King says in that speech, that does not mean that we should not seek to remove by legislation what may appear to be objectionable discrimination. That's in the same speech.
Right.
And it's interesting, Mackenzie King gives that speech on immigration policy and not the Minister of Immigration. Mm. And the fact that Mackenzie King is giving that speech, he says, you know, he knew how far he could go. And he begins to see that, hey, after this sort of hyper-nationalism in Europe that led to the Second World War, you know, the extermination of you know, 6 million Jews in Europe. He saw the destruction and the devastation firsthand. And he said, like, those policies cannot be sustained. And we got to change them. But he was smart enough as a politician, you asked earlier, about playing to the political side. He knew that if he had opened up the borders to whoever wanted to come to Canada, he probably would have had tremendous backlash, particularly in certain parts of the country. And he knew how far he could go. And to him, compromise wasn't failure, but it was a sign of real leadership.
Now, You mentioned that speech that he gives on immigration. It leads to a question for me about just the idea of speech making and something that is, we mentioned earlier, prime ministers don't seem to give speeches anymore, long speeches, but the prime minister has a TikTok account and a Twitter account and like all the things. So it's short snippets. And it's something that has come up in discussion, and you see it on the news where they're talking like about these things. It's like, oh, are we doing things in these short snippets and we're not doing long form? Like there's no real context to anything. Then you give an example of a speech from 1947 that also the context is stripped away from it in memory. So as it relates to prime minister speech making, how important is it, or has it always been, for them to have little takeaways in a speech and things that can be a little microcosm of what the overall policy is? Yeah, you can talk for 2 hours, but people will leave with one or two lines in their head is what they'll really remember. How important is that? And when you're going through and reading the speeches, how, as a researcher and a historian, are you trying to balance what the takeaway has traditionally been with the narrative that comes out of a speech is versus the totality of what a prime minister says?
Yeah, you know, that again is something I struggled with. And, you know, today, if you look at Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, you know, he will have quite often on the podium from which he is speaking, he will have diversity as our strength. And, you know, and that's his one of his key messages. Whereas if you look at, you know, Stephen Harper, a strong Canada, you know, makes a strong country. But if you look back and, you know, some of the speeches that Mackenzie King had reproduced would be, you know, join the social revolution when he talked about social policy. Louis Saint-Laurent talked about prosperity. And so there's some speeches are just like speech for the prime minister. Many of them came with titles. Right. And the title would be reproduced sometimes in the newspapers or in party literature. And yeah, you know, I said I read thousands of speeches, but it was, you know, a prime minister had 6, 8, 10 speeches that they would deliver across the country. And quite often they would tell the same jokes, only substituting, you know, Sussex, New Brunswick for Saskatoon, Saskatchewan. And the same jokes, same stories. Yeah. And you read this, you say, oh, I'm sure people who were listening never knew that. Yeah, and sure, that was a farmer down the road, not from, you know, St. John River Valley, but that was one from North Battleford or wherever the case may be. And they're stressing certain ideas. They're stressing certain things. And most of the prime ministers, or all of them, are speechwriters. And the speeches would go, I think the one speech I found with, and I should say as well, that I was not able to get into the speeches of Brian Mulroney, Stephen Harper, or Jean Chrétien, because their papers aren't open. But for people like Trudeau and Diefenbaker and Louis Saint-Laurent and King, I was able to find drafts and to, in many cases, trace the various drafts. And I think the one that I found that went through the most drafts was one by John Diefenbaker. And I think it went through like 12 or 14 drafts. Jeez. And it would, so, you know, they would sit around the table, probably in the cabinet office or in the Diefenbaker's office, and say, like, I'm going to give a speech on the Commonwealth. And so someone would go off, probably Menzies or someone else, and draft it up. Then it come back to Diefenbaker, said whatever, he wanted more, didn't like it. Mackenzie King was the most difficult to please, because you would continually see notes that he would write. Like, you really can't expect me to deliver this to Canadians on, you know, D-Day or V-Day in Europe. And he said, they would think I'm completely daft. So he would go off and find an old speech and pull sections out as you do when you write a paper or whatever. Yeah. But it would be sent to the political staff. If it was dealing with economic policy, it would be sent to the Department of Finance. It would be sent to the minister's office, of course. And sometimes there'd be people around the country that, you know, would be brought in to be consulted on the speech. And so, you know, they put a lot of time and effort into it. And they all had speech makers. But I make the case, and taking, you know, reading about rhetoric and speech writing, is that speech writers are not idea makers, but they are salespersons. They are advertisers. They want to make the they want that special line. Except Paul Wells argues that Stephen Harper went through and took out anything that was flowery or anything that was sort of catchy, because he wanted his speeches to be dull. And he wanted just sort of one message, and that would be what would come through, and not, you know, nothing sort of, he wasn't interested in poetic language, so he didn't want a Mark Twain or or John Steinbeck or Margaret Atwood writing his speeches. He wanted them to be plain and dour and so on. But, you know, Trudeau spent a lot of time with his speeches, practiced them before he delivered them.
I'm wondering, does this kind of set the prime minister almost as like an actor, that they're giving similar speeches across the country to different audiences, but having to hit the same notes and laugh at the same spots and feign interest at the same points? Like, is there a part of the prime ministerial role that is that they are acting, that they have to be a good actor? And in the second half of the 20th century, look good while doing it, because now you got a camera on you everywhere you go.
Absolutely. I think I call this in the book somewhere or another, this is performance. This is performance. Right. And what got me interested in this project to begin with was, you know, I did a book on family allowances a number of years ago, and I sort of read a lot of Mackenzie King, and Mackenzie King promised in the 1940s all sorts of things I mentioned earlier. And, you know, social welfare was going to be the new, the new dynamic in Canada. And I remember Roy Romano telling me one time, he was friends, Roy worked with us when I was at the Policy Institute. And he came back from some sort of meeting with Kretschmann, and Roy would do this frequently, sort of take on the, try to intimidate and impersonate Kretschmann. And he said, you know, Kretschmann said to his ministers, go to Kyoto, tell them that Canada is a good citizen of the world, and we're going to do our part to clean up the environment. He had no plan. He had no plan, no idea how this was going to happen. And he continued to talk about Canada being a good global citizen. And I said, geez, you know, there's something here. And so if you look at the speeches, and I don't do this, but I think there's a book there, because I was interested in the message that their speeches were telling, not the connection between speeches and policy. But they all talked about doing different things. Like childcare. Like childcare was an issue that all the prime ministers from Pierre Trudeau through to Kretschmann, Mulroney, Harper, they all talked about, you know, a national care for children. None of them delivered it. Harper a little bit, but until Trudeau. And yet they all talk the story of, you know, Canada, peacekeeping nation. And of course, you know, as Mulroney used to say, Canada had more cooks and gunners in the military. So we couldn't do, and they loved those one lines, some of them. Some of them loved those one lines. And it is performance. It is performance.
Yeah. And I guess sort of to sort of get out on this, how does this influence us looking forward? We're going to have an election next year, barring anything happening this calendar year, which is possible, but scheduled for next year. And just moving forward for people who pick up the book, read the book, is there a message there or a way to understand contemporary politics, the contemporary role of the prime minister and the way in which prime ministers commute or the prime minister now and in the future, how they communicate with us?
I really wanted to do a chapter on Justin Trudeau, but it's still a work in progress. So I spent about 5 or 6 pages on him in the book. And you know, he is the first prime minister to, one of the things that I think in nation building and creating a normative story, unfortunately, there's a lot of forgetting. You know, we've taken apologies and made them about us being a good nation. And, you know, when Mulroney apologized to the Chinese who worked on the war, you know, he defines them as pioneers, that they were pioneers no different than the Europeans. But, of course, we treated the Chinese who built the railway much different than we treated the most of the Europeans. But with Justin Trudeau, it's like you want to, the normative story becomes Canada is not a great nation. Canada has done some horrible things, which is true. And instead of sort of learning from the past, as they all talked about, Trudeau Senior, Chrétien, Mulroney, Harper, and Trudeau wants the story to be probably what he believes to be the true story of Canada. And you're beginning to see a lot of people are saying, yeah, we did, and we see this around John A. Macdonald. You know, John A. Macdonald did some horrible things, but he also did some wonderful things. The normative story, it becomes increasingly the evil things associated with John A. Macdonald. So going forward, it's going to be interesting to see how we can deal with the past as well as the future. And all those prime ministers have seen the past as a part of the future. Mm-hmm. And whether or not the two contestants for the prime minister's job can somehow or another be less, I guess, be more passionate and more caring about the state rather than scoring political points. And certainly Mulroney, and we saw this with the death of Mulroney, there was a rallying around, you know, people, you know, really had trouble with many of his policies. Many people didn't like Ed Broadbent, who died sort of not too long ago, but they found something there that was nation building. And whether or not the new prime ministers are so much committed to populism and targeting, you know, the evils that exist in the world, rather than seeing, hey, yeah, we've done things that aren't great, and we need, as Mackenzie King said, get rid of these discriminatory policies. And that's a different narrative than, you know, we're just not a great nation.
Yeah. So, and that speaks to something we were talking about before we started to record of, frankly, people should go study history and go to enroll in history programs. We need that. We need more of that across the country. So the book is Canada's Prime Ministers and the Shaping of a National Identity. If people want to go pick up the book and all of your other books as well, what's the best way for them to do that?
Well, you know, I always, you know, your local bookstore is always a good place. From UBC Press, always a good place. And, of course, anybody who's selling books aren't bad people. So Indigo and Amazon will have the book.
And certainly encourage everybody to check it out. I will link to the UBC Press page in the show notes below if you want to check it out. So, again, Canada's Prime Ministers and the Shaping of a National Identity. Raymond Blake, thank you so much for joining me today.
Well, always good to chat, Sean. Take care.
So there you have it, my discussion with Raymond Blake. I thank him for his time. And again, Canada's Prime Ministers and the Shaping of a National Identity, coming out this weekend. As you listen to this, we are dropping this on June the 11th. Book is coming out over the course of the weekend, so you can go check that out, hot off the presses. And with that, let's get right into today's historical headline of the week, which comes from The Globe and Mail. Back on April 27, 2018, a special article by Erna Paris. This is actually an excerpt from a speech given to the Senior College at the University of Toronto on September 13, 2017, talking about multiculturalism under the title Canada's Multiculturalism is Our Identity, in which Erna talks about multiculturalism, why it was created in the first place, refers to it as a moment of political agility and the characteristic of Canadian willingness to compromise in the service of national unity, in particular following the Quiet Revolution and the October Crisis, and really goes through how various governments, including prime ministers, contributed to the growing idea of multiculturalism in Canada. Talks about the Royal Commission on Bilingualism and Biculturalism, and then, of course, Pierre Trudeau's introduction of multiculturalism into law. And through the rest of the speech, the discussion gets into why this is important, both to Erna and then the argument as to why this should matter to Canada at large, and gets into the idea of Canadian culture and multiculturalism as one that is not based on assimilation, but rather an integration into a core principle that is identified as citizenship. So a really interesting piece that gets at multiculturalism, the idea of diversity is our strength, that you'll see referenced a lot, that phrasing. This is a really good, in my mind, explanation of where that notion comes from and how, in fact, it plays out in communities across the country. So when we talk about how prime ministers in the second half of the 20th century, how they influenced a national identity, Erna Paris, in this speech printed in the Globe and Mail, gets into how that plays out on a more local, on a more micro level. And so a lot of the ideas that Raymond Blake is talking about in his book really touch on, are really touched on in this speech. So again, Canada's multiculturalism is our identity. Erna Paris in the Globe and Mail, April 27, 2018 is today's historical headline of the week. And with that, I'll say thank you so much for listening, everybody. If you have not yet, please do subscribe wherever you get podcasts, likes, rates, comments, all that good stuff. Helps other people find the show, keeps us growing. Of course, you can head on over to activehistory.ca, all the great written material over there on the website. And if you want to let me know what you want to hear on the show, whatsoldisnews@gmail.com. That'll do it for this week. Thanks again for listening, everybody. We'll be back with you again next week for more What's Old Is News.